second treatise. Rousseau, more open in his attack on Christianity, accused Christianity of undermining the unity of the state because a Christian gave ultimate loyalty to God. To replace Christ's teachings, he proposed a civil religion that makes, quote, the fatherland the object of the citizen's adoration, and so teaches that service to the state and service to the state's tutelary deity are one and the same thing, unquote. But there are also Old and New Testament origins of the American civil religion. For example, in the Old Testament, we find the prophecy of the reconstitution of nature in Isaiah, when he wrote, "The wolf shall be a guest of the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid." And also Isaiah's expectation of universal world peace, when one nation shall not raise the sword against another. And there's also Daniel's prophecy of a fifth monarchy that terminates and concludes history. In the New Testament, the book of Revelation speaks of a new Jerusalem, where God dwells among men and governs them directly without the mediation of worldly government. And of course, in the book of Revelation, we also find the symbol of the millennium. In America, our own intellectual classes fashioned a civil religion, which in its modern form was composed of a commitment to democracy, a progressive view of history, and a commitment to individual human rights. The commitment to democracy was not one of commitment to democratic procedures, such as majority rule, but to an ideal society, a utopian ideal applicable to America and the world. Here, a quotation from Herbert Crowley, founder of the intellectual journal The New Republic, is apt. Crowley wrote, "For better or worse, democracy cannot be disentangled from an aspiration toward human perfectibility, and hence from adoption of measures looking in the direction of realizing such an aspiration," unquote. The progressive view of history underlying this expectation of human perfection in democratic form is best illustrated in two passages from speeches of Woodrow Wilson. One, on September 7th, 1911, he remarked, "There is, approaching upon our modern times, a sort of expectation of still greater days to come, when every man may lift his eyes with hope to the horizon, when there has come a day of peace and righteousness, when the nation shall be glad in the presence of God," unquote. And also Woodrow Wilson said on October 24, 1914, that man has progressed and will continue to progress to that day when he shall live in the full light, where all the light that illuminates mankind shines direct from the face of God. I assume that's while we're still living. The commitment of our intellectual classes also includes a commitment to individual human rights that have been hypostasized, removed from their historical contexts, and made over into ideological goals, in the light of which historical communities can only be judged to be defective. I trust that in addressing the Philadelphia Society, that a critical reading of the following quotation from John F. Kennedy's inaugural address will not be met with catcalls. John F. Kennedy said, "Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty." This is beautiful, idealistic rhetoric, perhaps even necessary rhetoric from a president seeking to give conceptual clarity to his goals. But in practice, this commitment presented difficulties. First, it's not the liberty of the American political community that is to be defended, but liberty in general. Secondly, our friends were put on notice that they would be judged by the standards of an ideal liberty evoked by the president. Our relationship would be based not on mutual interest and security, but on their willingness to impose uniquely American concepts of civil liberty upon their own societies. Thirdly, this presidential rhetoric overestimated the capacity of American citizens to pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, particularly as the toll of deaths of young Americans in Vietnam was tallied. Fourth, since this ideal is not attainable, a skepticism about America's civil religion, about the ability of the present system to meet the exigencies of international politics, and a skepticism about politicians set in. In the first instance, this skepticism led to a reaction that gave us Richard Nixon's vicious realism, absent of virtue. And then there was a reaction against that, leading to Jimmy Carter's vicious idealism, absence of prudence. This is a dilemma of American foreign policy, but it has deep intellectual roots. Political science is the reason capacity to act, a capacity that requires maturity, experience, and openness to divine reality. To act politically means to act within a reality of ends that are given in experience and not made. But in the civil religion of our intellectual classes, politics is conceived as a massive project for the making of possible realities that are not grounded in any experienced order, but rest upon the speculative, even magical capacity of the politician to manipulate reality, casting it into any mold suitable to the imagination. What is required if we are to overcome the influence of this civil religion in American culture is an entire shift in intellectual consciousness. And let me summarize what I consider to be the main points of such a shift. First, our primary foreign policy goal ought to be to preserve and protect the free world. Second, universal peace is not a real possibility. Third, a commitment to human rights must be based on an articulated theory of justice. Fourth, democracy can survive at home if democracy fails abroad in those countries where there is no tradition of democracy. Fifth, the United States will not survive if our leaders do not engender civic virtue, a commitment to our basic institutions, and a sense of community, community on the level of consciousness of the common good. Balance of power politics in itself is not sufficient. My first point, that our primary foreign policy goal ought to be to preserve and protect the free world. I first began to think of this proposition when I learned from a young colleague in 1968 that in the nuclear age, survival as a goal is unethical. I concluded that if such a view were to become socially dominant, the end product would be our destruction. We must survive to ensure that the dark night of despotism does not descend on the free world. And to survive, we must do whatever is necessary to be victorious within limits. But what are the limits? For Plato and Aristotle, the limits were delineated by the Hellenic world. One standard of ethics was to be applied in wars between Greeks, another for wars between Greeks and non-Greeks. In the Christian era, with the new theological truth of the community of mankind, our moral obligation to our fellow mortals does not stop at our national boundaries. Strangely, this truth seems to have escaped the attention of the advocates of the policy of mutual assured destruction. I once had some fun with the third secretary of the Soviet embassy by informing him that our own targeting strategy was very immoral. It was aimed at the civilian populations of the Soviet Union, while his was targeted for our nuclear missiles and military sites. Instead, I said, to become equally moral, the United States should retarget our missiles to strike Soviet hardened missile sites, other military targets, and, of course, the residences of the members of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. The danger of the present historical moment is real. Our hardened missile sites are vulnerable to a first strike. Our bombers are obsolete. Our theater weapons are insufficient and in short supply. Our source of oil is in jeopardy. Our allies trade with the Soviet Empire. Our technical personnel in the military is demoralized. Our youth have not been given a rational argument that will persuade them to answer the call if and when it comes. Our commitment to civil liberty leaves the government vulnerable to massive civil disobedience, and we have become soft. In this context, the rehabilitation of our military capability is not a callous revival of the arms race. The Soviet Union has never stopped perfecting its military capacity. For us to respond is an act of moral obligation and courage, not an incitement to war. If we do not move to establish a balance of power, if the present disequilibrium continues, we will go to war, and the outcome is not optimistic. My second point, universal peace is not a real possibility. Once a year, I reread St. Augustine's City of God to prepare for my courses in the history of political theory. Though by now I must have read that work 10 times, if not more, I never cease to give my assent to Augustine's analysis of the human condition. For a man who is sometimes accused of being so otherworldly that he has little to say about pragmatic political reality, I find Augustine's observations on peace to be eminently practical. His civilization had collapsed, Christianity was held accountable for the collapse, and Augustine attempted to rally his fellow Christians to a consciousness of the community of the city of God. The peace of the city of God, he said, is what you would expect of a community of men who love God. Their souls are turned to God, they look forward with hope, while living in this life, towards a life of eternal peace after death. In contrast, the peace of this world is fragile, easily broken, and often more cruel than war. Will there be a moment in time, perhaps for 1,000 years, when men will live in peace? No. The millennium cannot be taken literally. It is but a metaphor for the age initiated with the coming of Christ. When I read these words, I often wonder why so many intelligent people have found inspiration in the millennial visions of the United Nations. Of course, to say anything else than that the United Nations is our last best hope would bring down upon us a storm of censure. Better to let sleeping dogs lie than to raise the firestorm of disdain of our intellectual classes. But the political pragmatism is not the real reason for the endurance of the utopian notion that nations will turn swords into plowshares. Engendering experience of this apocalyptic hope is, I believe, a rejection of reality as it's presently constituted and a lust for immortality. Wars are not desired by reasonable men, but nor is a world absent of war expected by reasonable men. This suggests that an element of irrationality has become socially dominant in the modern era, in the sense that there are intelligent men who expect a world absent of war. The concept modern, however, originates in Petrarch's rejection of the Christian era for an idealized golden age of ancient Rome, and the attempt by Renaissance magicians to reconstitute nature through magic. And that rejection, I believe, is equated to my observation that the expectation of universal peace is related to rejection of reality. Modernity, by definition, is the rejection of reality. In this context, it should be understood that the modern quest for a millennium of universal peace implies rejection of the reality of our mortality. This rejection is not limited to foreign policy, but can be seen in the celebration of homosexuality, discussed so well by Mitch Dechter in a recent article in Commentary, in the regulations that will lead to the prohibition of smoking, as discussed by Peter Berger in an article not so long ago in Worldview. It's found also in the social dominance of secular views of history, such as Marxism and positivism, and in attempts to prepare for life after death through quick freezing, as in Woody Allen's movie Sleepers. My third point. A commitment to human rights must be based on an articulated theory of justice. I'm always moved by Genesis 1:26 that speaks of the Elohim having decided to make man in our image. In the image of God, man is made in the image of God, and so I must recognize my obligation to treat my fellow men with justice as a moral obligation. But recognizing our obligation to be just and dedicating our foreign policy to the imposition of reified human rights on our allies are two different things. My model is Aristotle, who tried valiantly to confront the sophistic notion that law and nature were opposed. The sophists, in the late stage of their development, had become moral relativists and argued that the laws establish principles of right or justice that have as their purpose to keep down the strong. So the natural strength of the stronger, which of right should prevail, the sophist said, is opposed by the laws of the weak, the numerically larger community of men who fear the strong. Justice really then, they said, is the will of the stronger. Aristotle's answer, no more than 2 pages of his life's work, is one of the most significant contributions to the corpus of Western political theory. There is right, there is justice, he argued, by convention. But there's also justice or right by nature. Justice exists by law and by nature. Yet because right or justice, or what is right or just by nature, everywhere has the same force, and because, he said, it nevertheless changes, It requires the judgment of just men to know which is which. The just man is the measure by which what is right by nature can be known. Right requires judgment, and principles of right cannot be enumerated in terms of specified specific rights. If we reflect on this observation, we can perhaps see its truth. Let me give you an example. I know that there are many rationalists here in the Philadelphia Society, but some of us are not rationalists. We don't seek a thoroughly rationalistic explanation of economics because we know that capitalism is not merely an economic system composed of immutable laws, but an historical phenomenon composed of religious beliefs, cultural traditions, family patterns, and deeply entrenched psychological attitudes. We do not care, therefore, who collects our garbage so long as it is collected. For that reason, we do not join the liberal attempt to define the human rights that it is the American obligation to impose on the world. What is right is not necessarily a right. All the same, we admit that there are moral limits, indeed universal human obligations. But we prefer that our foreign policy be conducted with an eye to our national interest, not human rights. In the economy of justice, who is to say that if we impose a white revolution in Iran and lose a vital source of oil, or if we attain equality in South Africa and lose our supply of vital minerals, or if we achieve democracy in South Korea and yet lose our ally, that we will have contributed to justice in the world? My fourth point, democracy can survive at home if democracy fails abroad in those countries where there is no tradition of democracy. We Americans are known throughout the world for a type of arrogance that is truly unique among the varieties and strains of arrogance that afflict mankind. There is, of course, much that we can be proud of. Until recently, our superior technology, organizational abilities, and entrepreneurial verve were hallmarks of the American character. We've also been applauded for our charitable acts. But there are aspects of the American national character that are less than beautiful. Democracy as a utopian ideal has so saturated the intellectual classes that we have become feared by non-democratic authoritarian peoples for our propensity to judge their own political life in terms of the American utopian ideal. The list of nations that have felt the sting of American foreign policy in this regard is numerous: South Vietnam, Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and others in Asia. And a multitude of South American countries have all felt the lash of public and private rebuke from American presidents and State Department officials in the post-World War II era. In World War I, we entered the war largely because President Wilson believed that the world would have no peace until autocratic governments had been utterly destroyed. Wilson viewed this conflict as a final conflict and saw the American commitment in messianic terms. Today, underlying the constant imposition of American concepts of civil liberty and democracy on our non-democratic allies is a complex of secular messianism, moral arrogance, and a profound lack of fundamental principles of political order. Self-government, from the perspective of the American civil religion, is better than good government. Self-determination, thus, becomes the supreme political good, and for its sake we are prepared to accept brutality. My objection to the arrogance of utopian democracy is first that it is intellectually bankrupt. The complex network of social interrelationships in non-Western countries is such that to impose a democratic model on these subcultures is to do no more than superimpose an ideological overlay that will be fragile at best. The substance of order thereby is disoriented, and what order existed previously may then cease to become to be viable, leaving only the ideological rhetoric of democratic ideals in which no one really believes. Thus, my second conclusion, our policy of imposing democratic utopian ideals on our allies is counterproductive. It is not in our interest, nor in theirs, and ultimately American boys will pay the price in blood. But can democracy survive at home if democracy is allowed to fail abroad? I don't believe that the real test is whether or not the Shah of Iran, Somoza, Batista, or Franco resisted our demands that they lessen the reins loosen the reins on their internal opposition. The ultimate test, I believe, is whether, in democratic countries like England, the party system serves the nation or only serves a few and radical segment of the nation, that within England itself, anti-democratic forces prepare for a coup. Or, for example, in Spain, Portugal, and Italy, will the democratic process leave these nations open to subversion by the Communist Party? And if the Communist Party participates in power, to what extent will their participation in NATO lead to the subversion of our NATO defenses? The true question, then, is whether we can survive as a free country if, in the name of freedom, our traditional democratic allies fall to the forces of totalitarianism or authoritarianism. And lastly, my fifth point, the United States will not survive if our leaders do not engender civic virtue, a commitment to our basic institutions, and a sense of community on the level of consciousness of the common good, because balance of power in itself is not sufficient. The United States is a political community. Our fellow citizens have common traditions, beliefs, concepts of justice and morality, and common interests. But if these things that we share are not articulated, or worse, are attacked by representatives of the new class, the public consciousness of what it is that holds us together will be forgotten. Particularly on the level of the theological truths of the American political order, I'm concerned that this public consciousness has deteriorated to new lows. We are not an autonomous entity, but one nation under God, and thus we have an obligation not merely to ourselves, but to God. What we have in common with our fellow Americans cannot be simply found on the level of material goods and the freedom to pursue material success. Though important, the sacred truths of the American political order take precedence. We are not God's chosen people, but a people upon whom God's providence has been bestowed. We are not the best political culture in the world, but it's ours, and we're proud of it. Or at least we were proud of it until our new class discovered that successful careers could be made by maligning it. In this contest between the new class and the defenders of our constitutional legal traditions, we can find the answer to our present foreign policy dilemma. Our public past has no authoritative interpretation, since a major contest is being waged between those, on the one hand, who see America in terms of a utopian commitment to reconstitute the structure of existence, and on the other, those who see in our history lessons on the constitutional limits of state power. Our present existence has no authoritative interpretation because public discourse is divided by those who see presently constituted American society as fundamentally illegitimate and those who assert its legitimacy. That inescapable feature of life in the United States today contributes to the anxiety, tension, and disorder of our public lives, and consequently to the disorder of American foreign policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick, for such a penetrating and thoughtful analysis.